This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The COVID-19 pandemic is not just a health crisis, but one that has chilling ripple effects on many other aspects of our lives, one of which is education. Over the course of the pandemic, students lost close to 2 years of learning. The term lost generation has been used to describe this batch of students. While things are starting to go back to some level of normalcy, the consequences of COVID-19 towards education are still felt. But just how serious is the problem and what can we do about it? Dato' Dr. Amar Singh, consultant pediatrician and advisor at the National Early Childhood Intervention Council, and a number of other experts have come together to put together this document, a very detailed, comprehensive document, providing some very important suggestions. So joining me on the show today to discuss this is Dr. Amar Singh. Welcome to the show, Doctor. How are you doing?
Hi, Dashran. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm glad to be here. I'm doing okay. I'm trying to cope as everyone else is.
Yeah, certainly. Now, over the past couple of years, right, we've heard terms like lost generation used to describe the education situation in Malaysia as a result of COVID. This idea that an entire generation of kids have missed out on proper education for 1 to 2 whole years. But just how serious is this situation?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. I think it's not just one generation. I think it's multiple generations. Mm. I think most people probably use 5+ years as a generation. So a lot of kids from the age of 3 to 18 are affected. And also our students who are in university, I know medical students have been significantly affected in terms of their clinical learning as well. So we've got a bunch of multiple different generations affected. And I think the term most people internationally are using is education poverty or learning loss. And if you look at the World Bank report, Malaysia has got the highest learning loss in the ASEAN region. Only Myanmar is ahead of us. And that's not a good place for us to be. We've, of course, had very significant school closures, 41 weeks of school closure in the 2 years of the early part of the pandemic. And we had good reasons for that. There was a safety for the children, and that's a good reason. But we've lost a lot of schooling. The problem with that is that not only have children lost schooling, there's some children who have lost interest in schooling, which is, I think, a more serious problem. One UNICEF study showed that 1 in 5 inner-city children now do not want to go back to school. So the groups that we're worried about are the ones coming into school, the Standard 1, Standard 2, the ones who are in transition from Standard 5, Standard 6 to Form 1, from Form 3 to Form 4. Those are the groups that are probably most severely affected by this problem.
Right. And when you say losing interest in education, what exactly do you mean here?
It means that because they've not been able to attend online classes very well, partly because of poverty and device-related problems, they're not interested in going back to the education system. They prefer joining their parents in some work-related activity.
Right. And that is what, when I spoke to our former education minister, Dr. Mazli Malik, he brought up this similar thing. He said when he went on the ground and especially in certain rural areas, he saw that a lot of people have dropped out of school altogether and they are just doing unhealthy activities and whatnot. And it's no fault of these children, right? They're just caught in this situation. And that's what I want to ask you a little bit more to perhaps dive a little bit deeper is that for many people in our bubble, right, Doctor, our biggest complaints when we talk to, let's say, our aunties and uncles, friends and whatnot who have kids, is that online classes aren't as effective as in-person classes. And that is a big problem as well, and it's true. But for many others, or for most people in this country, outside the Klang Valley bubble and so on and so forth, the situation is much more dire, isn't it?
Yes, I think you're perfectly right there. We have on one hand children who can go online, but teachers are reporting that about 40% of those who are online also are distracted and not really participating.
Right.
But more importantly, from a large study done by MOE where they looked at device access and internet access, they found that about 39, almost 40% of all our children don't have a personal digital device that they can access to go online. Even those who have devices, many of them are using a handphone, which is not a particularly good device to access online learning. So we've got this huge chunk of children who couldn't access the online teaching that their teacher was offering. And then there are particular groups that had it more severely affected. I think those in poverty, those in rural Sabah and Sarawak, where internet access we know is already very poor, indigenous communities, we already got a huge dropout pre-pandemic of Orang Asli and Penang children who don't finish education. Now this has exacerbated their loss of schooling. And then, of course, we've got stateless and refugees and children in detention who never really got adequate education. The disabled in particular, because they're close to my heart, I've been very worried about them because they've lost a lot of their access to their special education teachers because they're the last ones to open, even when the schools have been reopened. So we've also got no idea of about 25 to 30% of children, because we know from MOE data that about 25, 30% don't attend MOE schools. They attend private, international home schools or religious schools. Mm-hmm. And we have no clue what's happening to some of these children. Perhaps the ones in private or international schools are doing okay, but I worry about the kids in religious schools and home schools, how they faced the last 2 years of learning loss.
I want to hone in a little bit on something you brought up about disabled children and students, because I don't think many people talk about that. Could you perhaps highlight what exactly they went through, their distinct challenges that they faced as compared to, perhaps able-bodied people and whatnot, or just, regular people attending online classes and things like that? What were the significant challenges that the disabled community had to face?
I think there are a couple of challenges. One is that because they have a disability, MOE rightly was worried about them coming back to school early because of COVID, and they're the highest risk of getting a severe infection. So they came back to school later, so they had more learning loss. Secondly, whenever you're doing online with children with disability, it's not that easy to get their attention. And I think in particularly the children with autism, their parents have all told us that they're struggling to maintain their attention. And teachers who don't engage their parents to do online learning, then that child is definitely not going to be present there. But there's another thing. A lot of children with disability need preparation for school. They need to be made school ready. And because we lost our preschool disability services this last 2 years, a lot of children who are entering Center 1, Center 2, who have a learning problem, or some other disability, are just not prepared for school. They may not even be potty trained, or they may not even be knowing how to sit down and concentrate at a table task. So I think they face significant more challenges than the average child.
Right. And what about these preschoolers, right? Because over the past 2 years and stuff, most of the conversation revolved around students taking major examinations, students who have assignments, and how these things, it's a big challenge because of online learning and lack of access to technology and devices and lack of infrastructure and whatnot. Not many people highlight this importance of this preschool phase because people think, they're just kids. Talk to me about the importance of preschool, what students learn in preschool, and how that was affected by the pandemic. Because these students are not taking exams. Their education is not about getting grades and whatnot. It's much more significant than that.
I think this is an unrecognized area, and thank you for bringing it up. I think the preschool area is where we learn considerable amount about how to relate to other people in a classroom environment, how to sit down and do a table task. And of course, we learn our early skills, which are our reading and writing skills. So if you don't go to kindergarten or preschool education for 2 years, you're definitely not going to be school ready. This is a term many industrialized countries use, school ready. If you're not school ready, you get left behind your peers. But what's happened during the pandemic is that many parents haven't been able to afford preschool services because of their job loss and economic downturn. In addition, 25% of all our kindergartens and preschool education services had closed down because they couldn't afford to stay open. They couldn't afford to pay their staff because of all the shutdowns. So we estimate right now that about 40% of all our children who are coming to Standard 1 and Standard 2 right now don't have the reading and writing skills. So it's going to be a huge disparity between those who can read and write and those who can't. And trying to be a teacher in a classroom with 30, 40 kids, trying to help these kids with their basic skills is going to be very, very tough. And as I mentioned, the additional problem is those with disability are even further pushed behind. Those with learning problems are just not school ready, because many of the early intervention programs, the disability programs that were run by NGOs to prepare them from school, have also been lost in the last 2 years.
Right. So what you're saying is that right now, like when we look at the reality on the ground, there are many students in primary ones and primary two in which their teachers, who are supposed to now start teaching them, basic maths, language and all these kinds of things, trying to advance their language a little bit. Now the teachers have to then teach them how to use the toilet, how to not, beat your friends when they're not sharing things. Is that what's going on in class?
Yeah, you'll have to get the children to sit down at a chair and not walk about. You'll have to get them to know how to use a pencil, how to write an A and a B. Usually these things are settled. There's a minority of children who normally come into Center 1 without these skills. And, those are sent to remedial class and stuff like that. Now the portion is so huge that it's not possible to support all the children with their existing resources.
Right. So what are the major implications of everything we've just talked about?
I think that one implication, short term, is going to see a much larger dropout. Right now, we don't have good, accurate data on dropout from school, and we do need that. As I said, especially those who don't enter Standard 1 at all, or those who in the transition years who drop out, we need that kind of dropout. But we know that there is going to be a major dropout from school. And then what's going to happen is that because children are not being educated effectively, we're playing a lot of catch up right now. You can imagine the impact this is going to have on our labor force. We're not talking today. We're talking 15, 20 years from down the road. We're going to have a lot of people who are less skilled than they were before. And thirdly, this is going to have a major knock-on on our economy down the road. So we actually must think of 20, 25 years from now, the implications of all this. There's an additional problem, as you mentioned, children who drop out, some not working, they're going to be increased social problems related to this. There's a final issue that most of us have been worried about. Even the children who have come back to school, many of them have mental health concerns. Many of them have worries about schooling and pandemic. So that is an additional challenge that we're going to see in this time.
On the show with me today is Dr. Amar Singh, consultant pediatrician and advisor at the National Early Childhood Intervention Council. After the break, I ask him for solutions to the problems we've been discussing. Keep it here on Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is Dr. Amar Singh, consultant pediatrician and advisor at the National Early Childhood Intervention Council. And we're talking about a lost generation of students who had no or limited access to education over the course of the pandemic. And what are the possible solutions to this problem? So, Doctor, looking at the stop-start nature of the education process over the past year, do you think that this was something that was unavoidable given the pandemic, or could this have been handled better? Because earlier on, you brought up this very alarming sort of finding, which is that if you look at our region, Malaysia is the second worst affected in terms of education, and we are only ahead of Myanmar. And Myanmar, you can sympathize on a very deep level because they had a military, on top of the pandemic, they had a military junta takeover, like war. I mean, it's like a civil war, and people are protesting on the streets, and massive job losses. There are killings going on the streets and all that. It's a completely different situation to what we have faced in Malaysia, which is, yes, some political, maybe a lot of political turmoil, but for the most part, our challenges were the health crisis and like the subsequent effects of it. How did we get to this point where we are the second worst in our region? What didn't we do right?
I think that, first of all, it's a challenge that most countries face. Very few countries did not face it. Perhaps New Zealand and Taiwan, two countries that controlled their pandemic phenomenally, didn't face this in the last 2 years. So I've read reports from UK where they talk about children having lost learning ability, even lost ability to make friendships. I read reports from Europe. We show poor online learning ability. So it's not unique to us. Of course, some countries have shorter periods of lockdowns, But, you know, that higher amount of children who got ill, severely ill and admitted, and we've kept that number down. So I think that we haven't done that much damage in that sense in terms of caring for our children's health. But what we have not done, which other countries have done, they've moved very quickly to bring back very concerted efforts to change the education system. They, of course, have more robust systems than ours. When you compare with countries, industrialized countries, they have more robust education systems. They have invested more financially in the education systems. But more importantly, they have recognized this problem early. They put in the resources to support the teacher and bring back the education system back to where they want it to be. I think we've not done enough of that. We've not recognized this problem, which is why we wrote this document and released it, because we want people to be aware that this is a crisis, actually an emergency, as we call it in our country.
Right. And do you think the ministry, like over the past couple of years, when the pandemic hit, it was something shocking to the world. It's like everybody was learning on the fly and all. But now 2 years down the road, research has been done about it. Articles have been written about it. People have talked about this lost generation thing for more than a year already. Has the Ministry of Education provided concrete solutions to this problem today?
Dashan, that's a hard thing to answer, but right. from what I've read and looked at, I've not seen enough. Maybe they haven't shared it with us. That's a problem.
Right.
It would be good that they're more transparent and share what they're doing. But if you look at other countries that have actually shared what they've done, they've actually changed the classroom environment considerably. They made it safer earlier for children to go back. Many of us have been talking about better quality masks for children and ventilation, significant ventilation, so we can bring our children back earlier. And of course, mass testing, as some countries have done. But we have not put in those things. I think that would have shortened our duration of significant lockdowns if we could have brought children back better earlier. Even now, there's a fear among some parents about sending children back because of fears of COVID. And we have not fixed the classroom environment adequately. So I believe that we have made some efforts, but we have not made the efforts that are significant enough to support our children and not to mention support our teachers as well.
Right. So let's talk about, we've talked about the problems. Let's talk about some of the solutions. In the document that y'all sent out, you listed about a few, six solutions, key initiatives that you guys have suggested. Perhaps you can break those down a bit. What can be done? What are some of the initiatives that you and other signatories have in mind?
Yeah, actually, we've suggested 12 major initiatives, but those six were probably the ones that are most important to highlight. Okay. So you put them on the front page for people to listen. And perhaps in saying it, I think it's important to say that the Ministry of Education shouldn't go on this alone. They need support. I think this is a time to call in, civil society organizations, to call in corporate bodies just to get involved. And we try to write what we thought were the best practice that we can find from the world. That means we read an enormous number of documents, look at what other people are doing and suggest from evidence what the best practice is. And they're doable solutions that we're suggesting. So the first suggestion we have is that you actually need an individual assessment of every child to know their status, because you can't have one plan for everybody, because children are going to fall through the gaps. And we must do an assessment that doesn't burden teachers. So we've suggested in our appendix a rapid assessment system that teachers can use, that MOE can use to understand the child's situation. So this can then help plan the services for that particular child. And we have also asked that we remove at the same time burdensome paperwork from teachers so that these assessments don't, add to their workload. The second very important one is we must identify vulnerable schools and children. The situation is not uniform in the country. There are going to be places which are far worse, like we talked about rural Sabah, for example. And so they require more support, more financial aid. And one of the financial aids we need to give is that we need to recognize poor families that can't afford to send their children back to school anymore because they need them in the workforce or something like that. And we suggest that the Ministry of Finance actually offer these parents 1 to 2 years of committed support financially so that they can send their children back to school. And that's a caveat. If you send the children back to school, we'll give you this financial support. So that's the second very important step that we need to take. The third one is what we talked about in terms of preschool and the transition years. We do believe we need extra manpower. We can't leave our teachers without support. And so we need to bring an extra teacher into every Standard 1 and Standard 2 class in the country. Now, when you employ this, we don't necessarily need to employ teachers. We could employ school leavers as long as they're literate, because we're trying to teach the children basics of education. Right. We could, of course, ask retired teachers to come. We could also actually ask people who are unemployed right now in other occupations, because lots of people have lost jobs. It's actually a win-win, because there are people in our country who need to be employed this time, and we need their manpower, their place in to aid these children. And of course, they'll be supervised by their existing class teachers. So that's the third important thing, to bring back manpower. Most good countries have got only a class of 20. And even then, they have about 20, 25, and they have two teachers. We've got a classroom of 30 to 40. So we definitely need a second teacher in. And maybe this is a long-term goal to aim for as well. The fourth one we suggested is to look at the preschool sector, both for the kindergartens as well as the early intervention learning disability services. Because if we don't resurrect that service now, we're going to drag this crisis for another 2-3 years, because there's no way those self-running services, those NGO-run services are going to dig themselves out of a hole so quickly. So we've suggested maybe 50% finance of their staffing and their overheads for the next 2 years to get them back up and running. And again, we've suggested who can identify them. We both have national preschool organizations as well. I belong to national disability organizations, and we can identify for the government who needs help, so there's not just money being put down the wrong place. The fifth one is the dropouts. Now, we know they're dropouts. We need to reach out to them, and this requires a personalized approach. I think we should use many resources, not just teachers, but the teachers probably know who drop out. But they can enlist civil society organizations. They can enlist NGOs. They can enlist their members of parliament, their local representatives to actually reach out, pay home visits, and find out what the problem is. Some of the children won't come back. And for those children who don't come back, we need to fast track them to vocational skill programs. We can't just leave them without, ability to move forward in the occupation. So I think this is a time to grow our vocational skill programs for these young children who drop out. Most of them probably teens right now.
Right.
And finally, the last one is, we know we've got a mental health pandemic together with the COVID pandemic, and that's affecting teachers and children. And we need to address this. We've suggested using the Malaysian Medical Association and using national mental health professional organizations to create a simple tool to first identify both teachers and children, secondly, offer them support. We've also suggested international programs which have been translated into Bahasa and available to roll out as a means to be used in school by the teachers.
Right. I'm glad you brought up the whole mental health side of things, because that's, again, something that I think needs more conversations. That we need more discussions around that. What has been the impact of the past 20 months on students' and teachers' mental health, and how has that affected education?
Okay, we don't have good Malaysian data, but I've read data from our region. There's even good data from China and other countries showing that at least 20-30% of children are not in good shape. Even pre-pandemic, there's a National Health Mobility Survey in our country showing that our children had significant mental health problems, probably at least 1 in 5. So we're probably looking at doubling that. So we're probably looking at 20-30% to maybe up to 40% of children struggling. And the things we're struggling with is anxiety, depression, and of course, post-traumatic stress disorder. You've had 2 years of COVID fears. You've not been able to mix with colleagues. You've reduced your social contact. I think most of us also so glad to be able to see our friends again right now.
Right.
A lot of children ask me, actually, I did a lot of training during this period. Someone was with children and they asked me, when can I hug my friend again? The kind of questions they asked me. So I think that we do have to identify the children who did not recover, who are having ongoing mental health crisis right now, and fast track them through to organizations. We also have a list of a whole bunch of organizations available that are going to give pro bono or free services to people. And so the teachers can easily tap into this kind of services.
Right. And
I should also mention, we mustn't forget the teachers. They've also struggled. And they also need mental health support. And that must not be stigmatizing. If a teacher comes forward and says, I'm struggling, you know, Guru Besar and the MOE mustn't then, you know, stigmatize the teacher, but fast track her or him for support.
Let's talk about that a little bit, the support that and the struggles that the teachers went through. Because, you know, with this whole online classes, a lot of parents, and of course you understand, you know, parents want what's best for their children and all, but sometimes, you know, it's like, ah, these teachers, they don't know how to conduct online classes. What are they doing? They don't know how to get my child's attention and these kind of thing. I think the teachers received a lot of flack for, you know, not being able to teach properly, for not being able to grasp or grab the attention of the students. Were teachers prepared for this transition? And how have they suffered during the pandemic, especially with regards to the teaching and learning process?
Thank you. I think we do need to focus on teachers, not just the children. And by the way, I should confess, I'm an accidental doctor and pediatrician. I plan to become a teacher, actually. Just that I put a first choice as medicine because I thought it's another good profession for helping people. I think teaching is probably the most important profession, even more important than politics. Huh? And if you look at the countries that are doing very well, they actually recruit the best people in school to become teachers. Mm-hmm. And give them a good wage. And we've not actually adequately invested in our education system. So coming back to teachers, I think they've actually had to work differently. And that's not easy. I don't know how many of the listeners or yourself have actually tried to teach children online. I have done so. And it's extremely difficult to keep their attention online. Mm-hmm. It's far easier when you're running a session physically present. You know, you can interact with them much better. But online, you never know when someone's opening up another tab, another window, and actually looking at something else and not interacting with you. So I think teachers express that quite a bit, that they're struggling. They don't have the skill sets necessary, all of them, to do the online work. And then you've got to translate your work into a more attractive way. And so many teachers actually invested their own money to get devices and to do things. Their own resources. Some, of course, lost out in the tuition that they used to run, that they used to offer children, so they lost some finances there. Many of them had their own struggles, their own COVID personal struggles. So I think that it's not been easy for teachers. They haven't received the resources that we hope that they could. Some teachers have been good. They have produced videos online to aid their colleagues, but I think most fumble through this period, as I think all of us have done if we were in their shoes.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, you throughout this discussion, one of your key initiatives that you brought up is, you know, we need to do a rapid assessment and understand each child's unique situation and status. And earlier, you talked about how, you know, a student in Klang Valley may go through different problems than someone in rural Sabah and Sarawak and things like that. Do you think in Malaysia, we have this one size fits all sort of approach to education? Do you think that needs to change? Should we start decentralizing our education and, you know, even giving more power to school principals, to individual PPDs and all sorts of things, as rather than, you know, this sort of top down, everything is coming, all instructions come from Putrajaya sort of approach?
Yeah, I think that's the approach that many countries have taken. Mm-hmm. They may not call it decentralizing, but if you look at our document, we actually wrote that, you know, although this is a national plan, but we want an individualized or a local face to it.
Right.
And, you know, there must be a way to recognize different needs in different places. And we must trust the Guru Besar and the teachers on the ground and the parents, of course, not to forget. I think Absolutely. The parents are a very important partnership to know what the needs of their children are and modify this plan for their needs there. And I think that's what MOE needs as well, to have a modifiable plan. What most countries have done who move forward in the education system is use something called Universal Design for Learning, UDL. Mm. What Universal Design for Learning means is that it brings learning back to the individual person, rather than have a cookie cutter factory style learning style, which we have. You know, I teach you, you absorb, and you warm it out for the exam kind of thing. I almost call it a photocopying kind of a system. But what they do is they actually make the teacher a facilitator. They encourage each child to learn at their own rate. You know, so that every child, whether they are gifted or having a learning disability, all can move forward. The aim is to continue to learn, not to worry about a benchmark assessment. They don't have benchmark assessment in many good countries. They have individual assessments. You've made improvement, that's well done. You know, that's the kind of thing they look at. And they have an individual education plan written for each child. So that child, you know, the parents and that child know where they are. And teacher knows where they are. And that is usually written with the parent. And if the child is older, written with the child as well. So I think that's what a real decentralized education system looks like, where we bring education back down to the individual needs. And we know that each person learns differently. Some people are more visual. Some are more written. Some are more audio, you know. So we need to recognize that and offer them a curriculum in a way that meets their learning ability, not the way we want to teach.
Absolutely. All right. Before we wrap this conversation up, do you have some final thoughts or a final message you'd like to leave us with?
Yes, I do, actually. I think we've recognized that COVID-19 crisis has worsened the existing inequalities in education.
Right.
We've always had inequalities in education. If you're poorer, you've got a worse outcome. If you're disabled, you've got a worse outcome. You're rural, you're worse outcome. So we've known about those inequalities, but COVID-19 has exacerbated them. If you're a child from a rich family in the Klang Valley, you've probably got a private tutor and you're doing very well, but not so for others. So now that we're planning to come back and we're building back, I think we must build back better. We must build back to, you know, bring back equity and remove this barriers to education that are at the face of many children. So we give everybody a level playing field to come back education. And there are three things I like to suggest as we do this. First of all, recognize that we have a national emergency in education, which is an emergency for our manpower and economy as well long term. So there's no need to be embarrassed about it or blame anybody about it. It's something that COVID brought. So let's accept it, that we are in a crisis, and recognize it. Then only, I think, if we don't recognize the crisis, we're not going to do something about it. Huh? Mm-hmm. The second thing is we need decisive action. And we need it yesterday, of course. So immediately now. And the key in this decisive action is bringing in more, people to support the teachers. And this is not just, extra teaching staff, but also getting parents more involved and getting society more involved in supporting our education system. So I think we need to do decisive action now. Some of the things that we talked about in our document, and we need to do it at ASAP. We cannot wait till the middle of the year comes. We are really losing time right now. The third thing is we need to be transparent. I think that's a problem in our country in many things. We tend not to talk about our problems. I think just be transparent, say we need help. Don't say everything's okay. And as I suggested, reach out. I would say to MOE now, reach out. Many people are here wanting to help civil society, corporate bodies. I think there are a lot of corporate bodies who can actually support MOE as well, because MOE will need more finance as well to pay for teachers and stuff like that. So I think... don't be embarrassed. It's an emergency. Take decisive action and reach out for help.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
That was Dr. Amar Singh, consultant pediatrician and advisor at the National Early Childhood Intervention Council. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check us out on podcasts. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.